You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
Welcome to the Director Series Podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Fincher has long been a tastemaker when it comes to commercial American media. His two pilot episodes for Netflix's House of Cards, released in 2013, are simply the latest in a long string of works that have influenced how movies are made, how commercials are engineered, and how music videos have evolved. Due to House of Cards' runaway success, he has played a crucial part in making the all-episodes-at-once model the indisputable future of serialized entertainment, while reinforcing the notion that we're living in a new golden age of television.
This is the memo I've drafted on our Middle East policy we've been developing. Now, I want to borrow from Reagan. I'd like to coin the phrase trickle-down diplomacy.
I'm going to stop you there. We are not nominating you for Secretary of State. I know he made you a promise, but circumstances have changed.
The nature of promises, Linda, is that they remain immune to changing circumstances.
House of Cards had originally been a successful television series in the United Kingdom, so of course it had to be readapted for American audiences, who presumably have no patience for British parliamentary politics. House of Cards' origins stretch back to 2008, when Fincher's agent approached the director with the idea while he was finishing up The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Fincher was interested, and enlisted his Benjamin Button writer Eric Roth to help him executive produce and develop the series. After shopping it around to various cable networks around town, they found an unexpected home in streaming movie delivery service Netflix, who was in the first stages of building a block of original programming in order to compete with the likes of HBO and Showtime. Along with Lilyhammer and the revived Arrested Development, House of Cards formed part of the first wave of this original programming, which took advantage of Netflix customers' binge-watching habits by releasing all episodes at once, instead of parsing them out over the space of several weeks. It was, and still is, a groundbreaking way to consume television.
Did you smell that? The smugness, the false deference. She thinks I can be bought with a pair of tickets. What am I, a whore in post-war Berlin, salivating over free stockings and chocolate? What she's asking will cost far more than that.
Funnily enough, the reunion between Fincher and his seven-star Kevin Spacey didn't occur out of their natural friendship, but because Netflix found in its performance statistics a substantial overlap between customers who had an affinity for Fincher and Spacey on their own. As such, executives at Netflix were able to deduce and mathematically reinforce the conclusion that another collaboration between both men would generate their biggest audience. This also gave them the confidence to commit to two full seasons from the outset, instead of adhering to traditional television's tried-and-true practice of producing a pilot before ordering a full series. Admittedly, the use of metrics and numbers instead of gut instinct might be a cynical way to approach programming, but in this case, the idea really paid off. Under Fincher's expert guidance, Spacey has delivered one of the best performances of his career, and House of Cards has emerged as one of the most critically acclaimed serialized dramas around, rivaling the likes of such heavyweights as Mad Men, The Wire, and Breaking Bad. Fincher directed the first two episodes in the series, which takes place during the inauguration of fictional President Garrett Walker. Kevin Spacey has always been a well-respected actor, but his performance as the Walker administration minority whip, Frank Underwood, reminds us of his unparalleled level of talent.
I hold them all accountable.
What, retribution?
No. It's more than that. Take a step back. Look at the bigger picture.
I think I see what you're getting at. Kern first?
That's how you devour a whale, Doug. One bite at a time.
Underwood is an unconventional narrator, straddling a line between an omniscient and personal point of view. A Southern gentleman from South Carolina first, and a Democrat second, Underwood is a ruthlessly calculating and manipulative politician. But at the same time, he's endlessly charismatic and armed with an endless supply of euphemisms and folksy proverbs.
Where I come from in South Carolina, people didn't have two pennies to rub together. A rack of ribs was a luxury, like Christmas in July.
Although Spacey and Fincher haven't worked together on this close a scale since 1995, it seems they're able to slip right into the proceedings with a great degree of confidence and comfort.
Remember this moment when you resisted me. When you said the words, then there is no story. Get a good night's sleep, Miss Bonds. We have a big day tomorrow.
Robin Wright, also on her second collaboration with Fincher after The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, plays Underwood's wife, Claire. Every bit as strong and calculating as her husband, the character of Claire adds a distinctly Shakespearean air to the story by channeling the insidiously supportive archetype of Lady Macbeth.
You don't usually underestimate people, Francis.
I know. Hubris. Ambition.
You should be angry.
I'm livid.
Then where is that? I don't see it.
What do you want me to do? Scream and yell? Throw a tantrum?
I want more than I'm seeing. You're better than this, Francis.
Well, I'm sorry, Claire. I am sorry.
No, that I won't accept.
What?
Apologies.
The CEO of a successful nonprofit. Claire pulls her weight around the Underwood household and becomes Frank's rock during difficult times. Wright does a great job of making Claire inherently likable and relatable, despite her outwardly cold characterization.
This is the Washington Herald, Zoe. It's not TMZ.
Do you know how many people watch TMZ?
I couldn't care less.
Which is why print journalism is dying.
Then it'll die with dignity, at least at this paper.
You are stuck in the 20th century, Lucas. You lack imagination.
Maybe so, but right now I don't need imagination. I need copy.
With House of Cards, the Mara family establishes something of a dynasty in their collaborations with Fincher. After Rooney's career-making performances in The Social Network and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, older sister Kate proves every bit Rooney's equal as Zoe Barnes, a wet-around-the-ears journalist for the Washington Herald. Plucky, street-smart, and ambitious, Barnes is able to use her intelligence as a tool of empowerment, just as well as her sex.
Look, they let me off. It's all taken care of.
Honestly, Peter, do you really think these things just take care of themselves?
It was just this one time, Frank. I swear to God.
Then you must hold God in very low esteem, because we both know that's a lie.
Corey Stoll and Mahershala Ali, as Peter Russo and Remy Denton, respectively, are the standouts amidst the clutter of Fincher's supporting cast.
This isn't your driver's license. It's a Starbucks card.
Sir.
Sir, have you been drinking?
No, I never drink coffee at this hour.
Stoll's Russo is a politician from East Pennsylvania who has problems with alcohol and drug abuse. He's severely disorganized and impulsive, despite his promising intelligence and ambition.
So, when there's billions on the line, you can't not call me back, and I can't not show up.
Fine. Thank you for your diligence.
Eight figures to you in the DCCC. $6 million to build that library of yours in your name.
I know.
Don't make them throw money at your challenger next cycle.
Ali's Denton is almost the exact opposite. Super focused, disciplined, and exceedingly principled. Denton is a high-powered lawyer who serves as a great foil to Underwood scheming. Ali's performance also benefits due to having worked with Fincher before on The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Like all of Fincher's late career work, House of Cards is shot entirely digitally, taking advantage of the Red Epic's pure, clean image to convey the series' sterile, almost surgical tone. Instead of hiring a cinematographer that he's worked with before, Fincher enlists the eye of Igel Brild, who ably replicates the director's signature aesthetic. The cold, steely color palette has been desaturated to a pallid monotone in its treatments of blues, teals, and grays. Warm tones, like practical lights that serve to create a soft, cavernous luminous in the interior chambers, are dialed into the yellow side of the color spectrum. The aesthetic deviates from Fincher's style, however, in opting for a much shallower focus, even in wide shots.
Kern is out.
They're tossing him?
Technically, he'll withdraw himself, but yes.
House of Cards plays like an old-school potboiler espionage thriller, featuring shadowy compositions and strategic placement of subjects in his frame that are reminiscent of classic cloak-and-dagger cinema. The camera work is sedate, employing subtle dolly work when need be. The effect is a patient, plodding pace that echoes Underwood's unrelenting focus and forward-driven ambition.
I love that woman. I love her more than sharks love blood.
Perhaps the most effective visual motif is the inspired breaking of the fourth wall, when Spacey pulls out of the scene at hand to monologue directly to the camera.
What a martyr craves more than anything is a sword to fall on. So you sharpen the blade, hold it at just the right angle, and then 3, 2, 1.
It should be me.
A technique that's borrowed from the original British version of the show, Spacey delivers these sidebar moments with a deliciously dry wit, enriching what might otherwise be a stale story of everyday politics and injecting it with the weight of Shakespearean drama.
Power is a lot like real estate. It's all about location, location, location. The closer you are to the source, the higher your property value. Centuries from now, when people watch this footage, who will they see smiling just at the edge of the frame?
So help me God.
Congratulations.
The foundation of Fincher's use of this technique can be seen in 1999's Fight Club, where he had Edward Norton address the audience directly in a few select sequences. House of Cards fully commits to this idea, doing away with the conventional voiceover entirely. While it's been used in endless parodies since the series' release, the very fact that the technique is commonly joked about points to its fundamental resonance. Another visual conceit that has been copied by other pop culture works is the superimposition of text message conversations over the action, rather than cutting to an insert shot of the message displayed on the cell phone screen. Considering that characters have been texting each other in movies for almost 10 years now, it's surprising that it took us this long for the on-screen subtitle conceit to enter into the common cinematic language. It's an inspired way to dramatize pedestrian, everyday exchanges. And in the context of the show, these texts become the modern-day equivalent of the coded messages found in classic cloak and dagger stories. Behind the camera, Fincher retains most of his regular department heads save for one new face. Donald Graham Burt returns as production designer, creating authentic replicas of the hallowed halls and chambers of Washington, D.C. Kirk Baxter, who normally edits Fincher's features with Angus Wall, goes solo in House of Cards, weaving everything together in a minimalist yet effective fashion. The ever-dependable Ren Kleiss returns as sound designer, giving an overly talky drama some much-needed sonic embellishment. The only new face in the mix is Jeff Beal, who composes the series' music. Beal's theme for House of Cards is instantly iconic, fueled by an electronic pulse that bolsters traditional orchestral strings and horns, echoing the romantic statues of fallen heroes that dot the DC landscape with a patriotic, mournful sound. The series doesn't rely on much in the way of needle drops, so Fincher's inclusion of two pre-recorded tracks is worth noting. The first episode features an inaugural ball where we hear Dmitri Shostakovich's Second Waltz, which cinephiles should recognize as the main theme to Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. Additionally, the second episode features Leonard Skinner's Freebird when Russo goes to visit a conspiracy theorist in rural Massachusetts. While not exactly the most original choice of music, it's appropriate enough and evokes Fincher's rock and roll music video roots. For visionary directors like Fincher, television is a difficult medium, primarily because of the need to work within a strictly defined set of aesthetic boundaries. While this is changing and becoming a better stage for visually dynamic work every day, the conventional ideal is to direct the pilot so as to set the style and make the entire series conform around it. In that regard, House of Cards as a series absolutely oozes Fincher's influence, despite the rest of the episodes being helmed by different directors. This phenomenon can be ascribed to the fact that Fincher's episodes dovetail quite nicely with several themes and imagery he's built his career on exploring. Take the opening titles, for instance. While they are usually part and parcel with a conventional television experience, Fincher makes them his own by showing time-lapse footage of Washington, D.C. locales, suggesting the bustling scope of his stage, while further exploring the passage of time as a thematic idea. This theme is also reflected in Fincher's depiction of D.C.'s iconic architecture. Like he did in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, his compositions and location selections, when taken as a whole, suggest a clash between the old Washington and the new. Old D.C., marked by classical colonial structures like the White House and the Lincoln Memorial, face off against the growing tide of steel and glass towers, or the modern infrastructural design of subway stations. A key takeaway of House of Cards is that Washington, D.C., a city defined by its romantic memorials to the past, is increasingly modernizing into a world city of the future. This transition is aided by mankind's increasing dependence on, and complicated relationship with, technology, another core idea that Fincher has grappled with throughout his career. House of Cards' focusing prism is communication. Cell phones, text messages, the internet, Apple computers, CNN. The series goes to great lengths to depict how information is disseminated in the digital age, with government and the media forming a complex, symbiotic relationship.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
In asking the audience to root for, essentially, the bad guy, House of Cards echoes the strong undercurrent of nihilism that marks Fincher's stories.
Nobody can hear you. Nobody cares about you. Nothing will come of this.
Why don't you let these nice gentlemen take you around?
Underwood is less of a protagonist than he is an anti-hero. Objectively, he's a bad person who's scheming to outright steal the presidency to rule the free world as he sees fit. In real life, we'd react to this sort of notion with outrage. Just ask anyone who's ever irrationally obsessed over the birth certificate of a certain standing president. However, we can't help but root for Underwood to succeed, simply because he's just so damn attractive and charismatic, on top of actually being, you know, a fully fleshed out relatable person with moral shades of gray, and not a stock villain archetype. House of Cards' groundbreaking release was met with quite the warm reception. It was nominated for several Emmys, a big deal for a series that hadn't been broadcast first on television, and launched Netflix into HBO's orbit in terms of compelling original content. For Fincher as a director, House of Cards served as a great comeback after the disappointment of The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. The series is a confident exploration of man's lust for power and our complicated governmental structure, and wouldn't be nearly as successful without Fincher's guiding hand. Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you,